Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
After the lights go out on Talk Sport.
I'm Steve Harmison. I represented England in 63 tests and 58 one-day nationals and won the Ashes twice with my country.
And I'm Leo McKenzie. I've experienced life as both a Premier League footballer and professional boxer. In this series, we're focusing on elite athletes and their transition from professional sport to civilian life.
We both enjoyed the highs and lows unique to professional sport. A vocation which can lead to adulation and riches beyond the means of the vast majority of people.
However, we also struggled with what followed when our respective careers came to an end, with the roar of the crowd becoming a fading memory and the adrenaline-fueled lifestyle was no more. Tonight on TalkSport, we are joined by one of the great batsmen from the modern era of English cricket, a man who represented England in 76 test matches and 123 one-day internationals, Somerset's finest, Marcus Trescothick.
Magnificent stroke from Trescothick.
Behind the air, that's going to go all the way. Very big hit there from Trescothick.
It's full, it's through, and it's four. And it's 200 to Marcus Trescothick.
We'll be joined by Marcus in a moment, but first, Steve, you played many times alongside Marcus for England. What are you expecting from this interview?
Very frank, very honest. Somebody who was one of the best players that I played alongside. His condition, like we've both got, and many other sportsmen have suffered in the past, was probably the first one that came to the public eye in 2006. Anxiety, depression, the mental health issue was something which ended his career and, you know, pushed him back towards Somerset as a player who played for 27, I think he played 27 years of professional sport, which is a phenomenal achievement, but it curtailed. And when you look, and I'm saying curtailed, 76 test matches, 123 one-day internationals, that's a lot. But when I think of Marcus Trescothick, that could have been 150 test matches and 300 one-day internationals if
it wasn't for
this
the mental
struck
health
down
conditions.
From this illness and this condition. So I've read his book, been through the majority of his playing career from an England player's point of view, and somebody who is very frank and very honest and very open with the condition he has. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, let's see what the great man's got to say. I'm delighted to introduce tonight's guest on After the Lights Go Out. It is a pleasure to say good evening to Marcus Trescothick. Well, Marcus, firstly, thanks for coming on. And
no worries.
I really appreciate it.
Trez, you had sort of two retirements from cricket, you know, your high-profile departure from the England scene in a time when, obviously, I was involved in and I seen firsthand of what you were going through and could relate a lot to that. And then obviously last year, you know, at Somerset, when you finally Peter Pan finally retired from cricket and you got away from it. I was going to say, how is it away from the game of cricket, but you're still in it? So have you gone from sort of taking your big bats home and looking after them, putting new grips on and shining the bottom bits, to the little bats that you do now for catching practice? How has that been?
It's been good, really good, actually. I was worried for a long period of time about the sort of transition out of the game and into the next career, what it was going to be like, really. And I think you sort of plan and try and do what you can to put things in place so that it works. And I guess I might have succeeded in that, in the fact that I had my last couple of years whilst still playing, that I could still go away and do a bit of coaching or go away and do a bit of punditry with on the TV and things like that, really. So I was sort of gaining experience, going into different environments, and sort of learning a new trade. And that really helped when it finally came to the point of hanging them up. And do you know what? I've not missed it. I thought I would be, you know, sort of chomping at the bit, trying to get back into it, or, you know, wanting to go and have a bat, but I haven't, which has been good to me, really. I'm pleased with that. So I get a lot of my joy now from the coaching and the slinging.
When you came away from the international scene and you went back to play domestic cricket, I know you went for, you know, there was a reason because of that, but was it a relief that because you just enjoyed the game, or was it a relief that, you know, I'm away from the international scene?
Well, I still had the love of the game. I still wanted to carry on playing. It was just the extra demands of being abroad, or putting myself in that sort of situation where I was going to find it tricky. And that, you know, once I took that away, which I knew I had to do, I couldn't carry on in the same fashion as what I was. I couldn't keep putting myself through it because it was just hurting too much. That I had to give away the international stuff. I knew that I could still carry on playing domestic cricket and, you know, sort of playing and travelling within this country. That was never a problem, really. So, you know, it was an easy sort of move into that because I felt a lot safer, just felt more comfortable, and that I could deal with playing county cricket and the rigmarole that goes with that. So it wasn't too much of an issue, really.
Marcus, I'm going to touch on the homesickness side of things. You struggled with being away from home, and that caused you great anxiety with everything that comes with it. Also, as a child, you had suffered experiences of you know, being away from home as well. Could you like get a bit more into that in the respect of where that sort of stems from, and why you feel that really led into the real serious attacks of anxiety and depression?
Yeah, well, I think the anxiety feeling was something that was with me for a long period of time, and it manifested itself when things, like traveling for me, really sort of came and I had to go and do it. So back when I was 11, I went on my first trip away with the school, and I found that very, very tricky, you know, just very upset. And the feelings, exactly the same emotions that I went through at that time, were very evident, and sort of exactly the same as what I've experienced then and still do. I don't know why it came around or what caused it. It was just always my Achilles heel, really, of trying to do these little things. But
I mean, I hated traveling. When I was just to travel away to games, I don't know about you, Steve, but I just didn't like staying in hotels. I didn't like staying away. And I think it became more apparent to me when I actually had my own family and I had my own children. I hated it even more. So I totally understand where you would be with that. What about yourself, Steve? But you feel,
when you talk about traveling and being away for games, you were going away for 3 days. Yeah, you know, me and Marcus and the England cricket team.
Yeah.
You know, during that sort of mid 2000 time, we were spending 300 nights in hotel rooms. It was incredible. I spoke to a journalist yesterday because we're talking about writing a book on touring and touring life, and asking me what my thoughts were. And I said it was something which was, when you sometimes spend 14, 15 hours a day in a place you do not want to be. And the pressures come with touring when you're potentially going well in a team and scoring runs. Days fly by. When you're not scoring runs and everything is under pressure and your place is under pressure. I had a big problem with, you know, anxiety and homesickness, you know, which you obviously seen because you've seen me close quarter. But I felt as though if I didn't play, that would be the end of me. You were the trailblazer that came out and said in 2006, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, but I guess it got to a certain point now where, you know, I'd been living it for a period of time. It was just too much at that stage. I dealt with it for a long period of time, and it's something I got used to dealing with. More often than not, for the first couple of days of a winter trip, I always found it quite tricky. But I just put it down to, you know, that just a little bit of homesickness that I had, and it was just like, okay, I'll deal with this. Give it a couple of days and I'll be into it. You know, little did I know that it was more severe than that. And once it got diagnosed as anxiety to depression disorders, then it completely changed things because once it had a title, it was a lot more severe in my own mind. And I found it harder and harder to deal with it at that point. And that's when it, you know, it turned a corner and made it very much more severe and dealing with things, you know, in general life after that.
You was playing some of your best cricket when you was going through these challenges. And that's what's really interesting for me, because when I was going through a really bad, dark place in my time and I was playing Premiership football at the time, I was going through some horrendous things, like off the field, emotionally. You know, there'd be times, I remember reading you had a time where you broke down in Dixon's in Heathrow. You know, I remember the times where I've been on a tube and I've like burst into tears because of the anxiety and things that are going on. How did you deal with it? And when did it all start really being a little bit too much? You know, there's always like a trigger. So I was going through a divorce and stuff. What about, how was it for you?
So I reckon I could manage most of it to a certain point, and then it would tip over the edge, and then it becomes too bad, and you have to go, right, I need time out, I've got to take a week off or whatever it may be to really get focused on it. Yeah, so during the summer times, those periods were okay and they were manageable. It was only when I tried to, you know, challenge myself to go abroad again afterwards, it suddenly the barriers came up, and you know, and that's very tricky at that point, because I know then I was in a place where everything was irrelevant apart from just being happy and just being, you know, being somewhere where I could get back to feeling normal, and that's a completely different stage of my life. And then there was also times during summer when you feel a little bit rough, but you fight through it. You just grit your teeth and get your head down and crack on and get the job done. You know. But there are periods when you realise it's just too much, and that's when you needed to take a step back. Talking about, you know, Dixon's, when I was stuck there at the airport, knowing that I was about to try and do something, that this is not, I'm not comfortable with this, and it became too tricky. So you've got to do something about it, and my way was just to bolt and get out of it as quick as possible.
There's things that come to mind from mine and your relationship was, I remember you ringing me in Bristol, I think it was. You were probably staying at home for a one-day series in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And it was like, why is he ringing me? He's got five or six people in this team that he could ring before. And I remember you coming and sitting on the chair, and I was like, well, come on, spit it out. What's going on? And then when you told me what you were feeling like, I was like, there was a little bit of relief in me to think, thank God I'm not the only one. But it was also, one of my friends is in trouble.
It's funny, isn't it, how it sort of built us together. It definitely sort of brought us together. Because you're right, it was our relationship wasn't like, you know, you and Fred were, or myself and Jilo, for example. But, you know, afterwards, once we'd sort of connected in that way, it brought us so much more closer and helped each other, because we could then, you know, we had someone to talk to and mention things about things.
Marcus, you see, around the sort of 2006 year, do you think there was a stigma around cricket? Did you feel like uncomfortable to actually speak as you do today?
I don't anymore. I think at the time when I, you know, when it all happened for me, and once I'd got an understanding about what was going on, I kind of needed to. I kind of felt like, look, I've got to tell you. There was so much rubbish that had been written, and people have come up with stories which just weren't true. And, you know, I needed to tell the story to get it off my chest, because I was just constantly hiding away from various articles or interviews that I was doing. And it was like, this is just making it worse, because I'm then trying to cover my tracks, thinking, right, what did I say in that interview that I said I've got to cover this one? So I needed to sort of let it go and to say, look, here it is. This is what I've got. This is what I deal with. It's not fun, but, you know, like it or lump it, you know, because I've had enough of sort of hiding it away. This is what it is. And that's helped me so much. You know, writing the book was such a big thing for me, to tell people all about it, because I can then, even now, I can say to people, look, I'm still just struggling a little bit, I need a bit of time. And their understanding of it is so much greater.
Did you feel when you wrote the book, it was therapeutical? Because I wrote mine and I thought it was the best thing I've ever done. I laid it out there, and the guy who wrote my book, I felt as though he was like a therapist to me.
100%. There's an element of fear when you're going through it. Because you know, what reaction is it going to get when you finally go live? You know, and what, you know, when you're having to go back through and you have to read every chapter, and that I found that quite tricky. There was one moment I found I was on the train going up to London for a meeting, and I sat there reading a couple of chapters, and it almost brought me to tears then, you know, just thinking, going back through my own life story and sort of reliving it at that stage, because it felt so, so raw again. But it helped massively by telling people, and like I said to you, just being honest, That is the biggest thing for me that's made a difference, because I have nothing to hide anymore. You know, I've given everything that I've got, and you can see everything that I've had. You know, if you want to dig any deeper, you're not going to find anything, because this is what I deal with. And it still comes and goes. I'm feeling a bit ropey at the moment, funny enough, you know, just, you know, going through a spell where I just, you know, manage my sort of emotions and how I'm feeling, and then sleep's a little bit off, you know. So you deal with these sort of things on a regular basis. Mm. So it is out there now, which really helps me, because I can just be honest with myself and with other people about if I need to take a bit of time off, or I need a bit of, you know, need a bit of love somewhere. You know, it's just a little bit different.
Marcus, after 76 Test matches and 123 One Day Internationals, you retired from playing for England in 2008. Tell us the story of your recovery and coming to the realisation that playing for your country was no longer possible.
Yeah, I think it was difficult times. You know, if you think back to when it all happened and how it all operated, I kind of knew that it had come to a point where I couldn't carry on doing it in the fashion that I wanted to. So it became an easy decision to actually retire from international cricket, because it was just too big an issue to keep putting myself through it. My health was suffering. I felt awful, and it just made it an obvious thing that I needed to just say thanks very much. I'm settled and happy that I'll move back into just playing a bit of county cricket and enjoying my time there.
You got asked a few times, though. I know Andrew Strauss asked you in 2009 to come back, you know, but there was times, did you think as though you could come back?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I tried on a couple of occasions. Obviously, 2007, we went to Australia, and obviously I tried again to make that work. And then I spoke to, I think Kevin Peterson texted me while he was in his short tenure of England captain.
I fell for that one.
To see what I was going to do. And once you know, and I remember then speaking with Peter Moores and various people. But again, the closer I got to potentially trying to come back or even giving it a go, the emotions and feelings were just coming, you know, to the front again. And I just knew, it was just like, look, why do I keep putting myself in? I loved playing for England and it was great fun, but it's just too tough and I can't cope with the emotion that it gives me. So I have to walk away and just be happy and settled with what I'm going to do and play cricket for Somerset for as long as I could do at that point. And I was happy with that. I was happy with that. And I was comfortable enough to be able to go back and enjoy my time there.
I mean, Marcus, you say that you love the game. What do you think gave you the strength to say, I'm done, I'm walking away, like enough's enough?
I think it was an easy thing. It was like the emotion of loving playing for England and enjoying the highs and the lows of doing what you did, compared to the feelings that I was getting from, you know, from the anxiety and the depression side of things. That outweighed, you know, that tipped the scales in the wrong direction, and I knew I couldn't keep putting myself all that pain. So it was an obvious decision. I had to make that choice because it was affecting me too much. And it was just a simple thing at the end of the day that, you know, it was there staring you in the face that this is what I had to do.
When you made that decision, did you feel like it was just like a weight off your shoulder? I remember when I had my last professional boxing fight for the Southern Area title and lost by split decision, but I retired the next day. It was a massive release for me to say, I've given my best now, but there's no more sort of coming back as such. Did you feel the same?
I was definitely like that when I retired playing from Somerset. I knew that everything was done at that point. I remember I spoke to a couple of various people who I was involved with, a couple of sponsors to say to them, look, this is going to be coming out in the next couple of days. Appreciate, you know, all the work and help you've given me and go from there. And I remember sitting there and it was like, oh, just a bit despondent and a bit unhappy with it. But I think once it was done and a couple of days after the announcement was made, it was like, well, I know what this is. I know what's causing all this. It was obvious then that I'd made the right choice and I was comfortable.
You know, a good friend of ours, you know, I've been an agent for a long, long time. He tells me a story of meeting you off the plane. I remember in Canberra sitting next to you on the bus, you were sitting in front of me on the bus. I think you got 12 runs. I think Brett Lee bowled a fast over and you said, I couldn't see a thing that was going. And to be fair, when we're in the Sydney test, in the test match ground, it was a bit like it was a comedy sketch, because I remember Fletch had a migraine at the time. All the lights were off. You know, you came off the field. I can't remember who the doctor was. I think it was Nick Pearce shouted at me coming off. And he's like, can you come and have a conversation? Yeah, Trezor's having a struggle. And I remember talking to you and there was a lot of talk about Healy coming over, and it was like, this is, and I can remember saying to Nick Pearce, I've been through this, I know what this is like. This is not the right course of action, bringing his wife over. Marcus needs to go. And I remember Neil Fairbrother saying, when he seen you, when you first came off that plane, coming home, and it was probably was the end, the relief, and the as you had just come off a trip from Malaga or Marbella or Ibiza or whatever. And for me, Leon, that, to see the end of a Marcus Trzaskowski, this is like in the footballing world, it's like Harry Kane retiring now. Yeah. But the relief that you had when you got off that plane, yeah, was something, but I don't think anybody can describe that other than the people that have suffered.
Both times that I came back, once from India, once from Australia, was that the only time for that sort of period of the previous week, 2 weeks, I felt comfortable was on the flight.
Yeah.
Because nothing, you know, the decision was made. I was on the way home. I was in the air in a nice, obviously comfy seat. And it was like, at last I can eat and I can drink and I can actually get some sleep now because the decision is made. And that you're most contented at that point because you're in the air, no one can get you, there's no one going to bug you, and you're happy. But it was the best thing, getting off the flight was the best thing ever because you got through the trap door. Basically, I was in the hotel after about 15 minutes, I reckon, from getting off the flight the second time around, which was amazing because there's a door literally as you walk off the airplane, you're normally walking through the little tunnel. There's a little door there, if you ever notice. And I went straight down there, straight down into a car. I'm off and out the airport. And it was absolutely brilliant. But for the wrong reasons, of course. But, you know, you...
But for the right reasons for you, though.
Oh, of course it was, yeah. But, you know, experience little things like that was quite special. But I was, as you say, you know, just get me out of there. I was so bad that I was just like, just get me home. I just want to be in my own bedroom and my own house with my family and feel safe and get happy again. That was all I was worried about.
But rewind that back, maybe 72 hours. That feeling that you were going through 72 hours before was something that, you know, I remember experiencing. It is the worst feeling anybody could ever have. And that's whether you're from a privileged background, whether you play a sport, whether you live on the street. It is something that a human being, you know, unless you've gone through a dark time, can only describe.
Yeah, it's fear, isn't it? It's the anxiety, it's the unknown, you know, all of your little things that sort of get put together that are unpleasant. You know, your body's shaking, your mind is racing, you know, you're sweating, you're hungry, but you don't want to eat. It's just all these little different emotions that your brain forces upon you. It's in that heightened state of alertness and fear, which makes it very, very uncomfortable for you.
You know, sometimes it's all about the comeback. You know, sometimes we can retire. And I remember I retired from boxing and I was like, maybe I can just give it one more go. Because, you know, it's always that sort of fire inside us, especially when we're dealing with anxiety and depression. You know, I've had many days where I'm not really doing a great deal and I feel like I'm not achieving and I feel like I'm not doing anything, although I've achieved loads. So there's times where I want to be like, well, no, I need to get back. I need to get back there. Do you ever feel like you need to get back, or you wanted to get back?
Not anymore. As I say, now I've now fully retired from playing the game, and I've found my sort of drive into coaching in the next part of my career exciting. So I don't have it then, but there was definitely moments 2008, 2009, 2010. You know, I think there was what year did Jonathan Trott play? 2009.
It was talk about you coming back and playing that Test match when we won at the Oval.
I had just got back-to-back hundreds playing for Somerset. You know, you sort of envisage your ending of career at the Oval, don't you?
I
always dreamt of walking off into the sunset with a waving my hat and thanks very much at the Oval. I've had a brilliant international career and you put it to bed at that point. And I knew if I was going to do it, I was doing it for the wrong reasons because it was about what I wanted to do necessarily more than what the team needed. You know, even before it got to a point, before anybody really called me, I text Ashley because I think he was coach then, or I might have texted Stracey or someone.
Stracey was captain,
and I said to him, "Look, even if you're thinking about it, I'm not interested because it would have been totally the wrong thing to do for me and for them." And, and obviously, it was the best thing they did was obviously picking Jonathan Trott.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
After the lights go out, Leon McKenzie and Steve Harmison in conversation with Marcus Trzaskowski on Talk Sport.
Marcus, after retiring from England duty, you went on to have many years with some outstanding performances in county cricket with Somerset. Alongside this, how did you find managing the threat of anxiety and dealing with your mental health conditions?
I reckon the more I experienced it and the more I dealt with it, the better I got at understanding. You know, I think you build your own little coping strategies that you know will help you. And you can sort of go through that sort of routine when you're feeling a little bit rough or your thinking is not quite right. You do certain things. I know I do. I have certain elements and things that I know I tick off once I'm feeling quite as good. So
can you elaborate on the things that maybe you get through?
Yeah, real simple things. I don't drink a great deal when I'm feeling bad. I find that really doesn't help me at all. I avoid caffeine the same way because obviously it just pumps you up and keeps your adrenaline going more than anything else. I try and keep on top of training because I know, you know, just going for a gym session here and there really makes me feel better. The endorphins get pumping and mentally you feel a lot happier. I'll obviously be in contact more with my psychologist that I speak to, and I would up my medication. I take two different types of medication, one antidepressant in the morning, and I take an anti-anxiety in the evening, which I can sort of up and down a lot quicker and overnight if I need to get on top of things. And that's really helped me, having that little bit of a crutch to rely on something that I know within a certain period of time, a matter of days, really sort of gets on top of my anxiety and gets me back down to thinking and feeling normally. That makes a big difference for me.
When did you realise that, you know, what medication could be the way forward for you? Because I've never experienced medication. Have you ever experienced
it? Yeah, I still take it now. I take one at night time.
So both of you take medication, which is, you know, sometimes it works for some and sometimes it doesn't. But for me,
I have 3 days off it. I'm a nightmare.
Yeah, see, I've always been a bit fearful with the medication process. So I've had many trips to the doctors and I've spoken openly about, you know, why am I feeling like this and why am I, you know, crying about things and why am I emotionally just a mess? But I always felt that, you know, sometimes it's a little bit too easy to just start taking pills as such. But when I listen to you, Marcus, it sounds like it's been a massive help.
Oh, huge. I think more than anything else, so I've taken the antidepressant, which is the morning tablet, for a lot longer period of time. That would have been on and off since sort of 2006 when I first came back. I used to sort of go on them for the winter, come off them for the summer, but I found that I was getting too many ups and downs, and the downs were too hard to, what took me too long to recover from where I wanted to be. So I said, look, I'm going to just stay on these full time. And then the anti-anxiety is the one that's really helped me because that's helped with sleep and that's helped with sort of getting control of the anxiety a lot better and a lot quicker compared to if I wasn't taking it. Because there was a period of time where, you know, you take sort of diazepam and stuff like that, which helps mellow you out and relaxes you for a period of time, but it never actually cures any problems. It just masks them and it just takes away the pain for a period of a few hours. But I needed something a bit more stronger that really helped me. And I agree, it's not everyone's cup of tea. I combine it with a lot of other different things. You know, talking to my psychologist is a huge help when I'm feeling rough. I tried mindfulness and I tried yogas and I tried all these other things, but I never really found any benefit for me. So it's a case of I rely heavily on the medication, and I'm comfortable taking them because I appreciate if I don't, the downtimes are quite hard in relation to not taking them.
And Ches, we work very closely with the Professional Cricketers Association, who, you know, there's been that stigma of the depression, anxiety and the mental health issue in sport. I think they've been market leaders across all sports to be the first out there to help individuals and people get back on track to have a life as normal as they possibly can. But when you first came out in 2006, can you tell people how beneficial the PCA were, i.e. Richard Bevan and Jason Ratcliffe at the time, and now the work that they've done going forward? Because I know, speaking personally from my experiences, talking to the likes of Ratters and Bevo, there was horrible stats in cricket prior to 2000 of divorce rates and suicide rate in sport and in cricket. And that was something that I think they tried to push to help people, individuals like ourselves, to make us, you know, feel better about life going forward.
First of all, when I came back, it was crucial that I had somebody to speak to, and it was more Richard Bevan for me. So I spoke with Richard Bevan.
Yeah.
And I was then in front of a psychologist or therapist within like 2 days, and that's the same person I still speak to now. That was crucial because, you know, it's, if you go National Health as we, or NHS, we know it's tricky, you know, under-resourced, underfunded sort of area that can't get, you know, you wait months to try and get into it. So we were lucky that we had the union were putting straight things in place to try and get us the help straight away, which was absolutely crucial. And we had a system then which has grown massively since that point. There are now those type of therapists and other type of therapists across the country which are at the beck and call of sort of PCA or unions in general. But I know with the PCA that we have a system in place that if anybody calls in with troubled times, we can get them in front of somebody very, very quickly because, you know, that system has now been upped and changed dramatically to that, you know, we have the resources that we can fund into it. In terms of the sort of suicide rates, and, you know, people have talked about a lot about cricket in relation to, does it breed mental health problems? My answer to this is simple, is that until somebody shows me the facts of, yes, cricket in the style of game you play, because it's 4 days or 5 days or whatever it may be, and the emotions it causes you, this is what causes it. You are more susceptible to mental health problems. I can't believe that we're any different to anybody else in the country when across the board, it's 1 in 3, 1 in 4 people suffer with mental health problems. Mm. You think how many members we have through the Professional Cricketers Association, past and present. There's going to be 1 in 3, 1 in 4 across them, you know, that suffer with it. I can't understand. Is it just cricket has had more cases that have been talked about? I don't know. I need the evidence to really sort of trust that sort of theory at this point. And I don't know if there is then.
Marcus, do you think, I mean, I believe in triggers, and, you know, my sort of psychological battles definitely go right back to my childhood with things I've experienced as a child. But do you feel like it does come down to like the triggers that are in our life? You know, if things happen, we react to it. Some of us are a little bit more susceptible to mental health conditions to the point of more anxiety, more depression. Everyone's individually different, of course. I mean, you speak to some people and they don't really suffer like what I suffer from, you suffer from, Steve suffers from. Do you think there's got to be something that happens to us for us to then to fall into that?
I think our brain forges pathways and neural patterns, and it's quite technical, but you create these feelings by what goes on in your brain and how you've trained yourself. You could train yourself to kick a football, we could train ourselves to play cricket, and whatever we do, we've trained our brains to be in a certain fashion and reinforced it over a period of time. And it's just, you know, that's how you have to re-function. And that's the education side of it. It makes you better when you can start to rationalize things that are, in your own mind, are out of control, because they're not rational thoughts. They're not logical thoughts. It's just out of control thinking. So you have to retrain that and get it back in. And sometimes it's caused by a bereavement. It's caused by whatever it is, you know, addiction, whatever, these sort of things. And everyone has their own little thing that it's caused by. But it's, at the end of the day, we're all wired, and we've wired our brains exactly how it is. There's no reason why I've suffered with this for a long period of time. It might have been part of my upbringing. Mm. It might have been how I was born and how my brain operates. It's just sometimes people are more susceptible, is my understanding. Please tell me I'm wrong. I'd love to, if someone's telling me, if someone phones in and says, right, you're talking absolute rubbish, I'm happy to admit it. But
I don't think you're
the sort of thing I've learned bits and pieces about it.
You're in a process of now, you've transitioned into coaching. It's interesting with everything that you've gone through with your own challenges, that you've actually stayed in the game and gone into coaching and still enjoy it.
Yeah, look, I think having played for sort of 27 years, the transition out of it, because like I said before, that it was a little bit easier because it was a gradual process where I was getting experience during summer times and winter times to do that little bit of coaching. So it was the process was probably 3 or 4 years of the transition rather than being 6 months. Suddenly, end of September, job done, right, you've got to find a new career. The wheels were in motion for a good bit of time. And it's been okay, you know. I think cricket is always been my life, and I wouldn't know what the hell to do if I wasn't involved in cricket. So it's a natural progression for me to be involved at the front line still, throwing balls at people instead of being at the other end and hitting them. So it felt an easy progression to move into something on that lines, which I knew I'd find happiness and enjoyment at.
Marcus, in 2019, you retired from Somerset. It ended what, as mentioned before, 27 years as a professional cricketer. Wow. Mm-hmm. How different was that to the decision you had when you retired from England?
No, I think this was not easy, but... it was time, you know. I was crap by the end, so it was like...
It was time. You were 43.
I know.
There was only Peter Pan and Collie went on longer than you.
It was just like, oh, okay, I think I played, five games maybe in the last season, and I just couldn't match up to it anymore. You know, my eyes were gone. You know, you can't pick up the ball in the same fashion as you used to. You know, I remember concentrating in the final game that I played against Surrey at Guildford. Where normally, once you've batted for sort of 20 minutes, half an hour, the adrenaline is there and you're sort of like kicking into the concentration mode and you're just away. I just couldn't get into it. I couldn't get into the mode of thinking, right, I'm in now, I'm ready to go. I can go and push on now and get a big score. I just, you know, those times had gone, whether the brain power had left me or the emotions of it and everything was just... It was done, and I knew then it was a case of, right, you know, I'm not going to go and play second team cricket anymore. And, you know, as much as I loved playing second team cricket, it was great because you could educate the youngsters. It was like, I remember thinking a couple of times, why am I fielding here? It's like, I'm second team cricket. There's no one watching. What am I doing? go and actually do something productive and actually think, right, I can make a difference now by getting somebody else better. And it was obvious at that point.
So. I thought that throughout my whole career, to be honest, Trez, in the field. Yeah. What am I doing here? But, you know, say a 14 test match hundreds, you can talk, and I've said this to Leon, and Leon's probably sick of me saying, about the ability of Marcus Truscothick. I always made the joke that, you know, Kevin Peterson was the best player I ever played cricket with for England, but Marcus Truscothick was the best Englishman I ever played with. And when you look back at it, Trez, you know, 2004 from the Caribbean all the way through to probably what culminated us in my time in our careers was the 2005 Ashes. We've got to touch on some good times. We talk about the 2005 Ashes. Everybody's seen what happened on the field. What's your memory of off the field?
Can we talk about the bus trip after everybody had gone home? And was it Freddie had gone to sleep?
He did, yeah.
We're going back to the hotel, back to the Grange afterwards, and we'd been to Downing Street, and we'd done all that, and we'd had another drink.
Yeah,
I just remember you had a permanent marker pen writing all over Freddie because he'd gone to sleep, and it was just absolute carnage at that point. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. Trafalgar Square was just... That was the highlight of understanding what we had achieved 250,000 people standing in Trafalgar Square waiting for Andrew Flintoff to sing Suspicious Minds when he got the microphone on was just phenomenal.
It was the bus ride for me. That's when I sort of appreciated how massive an occasion it was, because everybody was lining the streets. And obviously, you know, it was probably, what, I can't even remember how long it took on the bus ride to get to Trafalgar Square. But, you know, to see everybody just leaning out windows, standing on rooftops, lining the streets was just incredible. And what I do remember, one of the big things I remember more than anything else, when we got to Trafalgar Square, it was absolutely boiling. We're all in our suited and booted, and we're half cut because obviously we've not had much sleep, and we've been another glass of champagne at the mayor's office. And I just remember feeling absolutely roasting, thinking, just give me a bed and just let me go and lie down, because I'm just absolutely shattered. But, you know, I think if we could relive those moments, and we kind of saw it a little bit with the World Cup, didn't we?
Yeah.
Last year.
Brilliant.
The excitement of, you know, what it creates when a national team does so well by winning a World Cup. I think it was 2003, wasn't it? The Rugby World Cup, where they had similar sort of a situation in London when they lined the streets the same way. So when you can experience it for yourself and you're actually on the inside of it, it's incredible.
Marcus, MBE, talk to me about that. And also, you're an honorary Doctor of Health.
Yeah, it's always nice. I think there's little accolades that come along.
See us how humble he is, Steve. Yeah, it's always nice. Like,
who would have thought me and you would be in them sort of categories, Marcus?
Stupid, unbelievable.
To think Dr. Marcus Driscothic MBE, sometimes I reel out. But,
sounds great, doesn't it? Say it again, Marcus. Say it again.
Yeah,
say it again.
Absolutely. You know, little things, small things that come along, and they're nice to be awarded and sort of collect as you go.
Yeah, Trez, you talk about careers and talk about all our life stories, but the family man, Marcus, you know, the children, you know, Haley and the kids, and how has Haley and the kids come to terms with Marcus, the dad, now away from the game of cricket, or the playing side of the cricket?
All okay. Yeah, it's, again, because, you know, it's been a fairly smooth transition for me. The kids are, you know, a lot more grown up now, 15 and 12, so, you know, things take a natural progression through life, don't you? It just brings its different challenges when I've got two, you know, young girls, almost teenage girls, that, you know, that's a different kettle of fish altogether. So I'm tested in different ways, I would say now.
Oh, you are. You ought to be in my household.
I'm sure, yeah. So we're tested in a certain way every day, but kind of understanding it a bit and getting used to it. But it's, you know, like these challenges for me, for anxiety, depression, will be there for as long as I live. So,
you've got a greater understanding. Yeah, you've got a greater understanding now. That's the main thing, isn't it? You realise when, you know, even for myself, you realise when the bouts come, and you're able to know, right, okay, it's here. What am I going to do with it? You know, there's like a fight back mentality in involved with that, which is so important. Yeah.
How long is it going to last? You know, what am I going to do about it? How am I going to get over it? You know, I've been through the journey a million times, and it doesn't make it any easier. I still hate it when I get to that point where I'm feeling really rough, but I guess you just have that little bit more confidence to know that this isn't going to last forever.
Yeah,
it's tough while it's here, but in a few weeks' time, I'll be back to normal and it'll be okay again.
I mean, it's so crucial that you have an understanding partner and someone that totally shows empathy and understanding towards, you know, the things that sometimes we feel like we're all alone with. I know that Hayley went for her own sort of postnatal depression and things that she was going through. And obviously you're going through your things. Hayley's going through her things.
Yeah.
How did you both, you know, get through that period?
It's a long time ago now, obviously. We're going back sort of 14 years when my firstborn.
But a period that could finish most, you know? When you look back at something, when I look back at certain experiences, and I've heard many conversations and looked in many lives, I think sometimes not everyone makes it. So it's a credit to you both that, you know, you're still standing strong. And like you say, as it is 14 years on, where you stand today and how you got through those times, because some people would want to hear that.
Yeah, look, I think we just got through as you do, as husband and wife, family, with her parents around, my parents around, and just you just crack on, don't you? You get the job done, really. Mm. I don't think we never looked upon it as anything different. It was just, okay, you're struggling a bit at the moment, I'm struggling a bit at the moment. Let's work it through. Let's talk about the various things you're thinking. Share tablets when we were both taking them, and, you know, and just sort of go from there, really. You just sort of crack on and get the job done.
So you became as one, even through even medication, you still done things as together.
To start with, yeah. Exactly. So she was taking various medication, and I started on her medication, so I was taking that for a period of time. You just get you get used to it, and you can sort of, you've got the understanding there, because I know, yeah. You know, she knows now what I feel like. If I feel rough, she knows what it's like. So.
And Trez, finally, before we say thank you and goodbye, what does the future hold for Marcus Trzaskowski, the coach, the person, and somebody who I think, you know, has still a lot to give the great game that we both loved and played?
Well, I'm kind of sort of mapping that out as I go a little bit. I've been lucky enough. I'm now in a position at Somerset as batting coach. And I've also had the opportunities to nip off and do a little bit of stuff with England, which has been brilliant, you know. I foresee that I will go along my coaching journey wanting to gradually progress and build up to becoming a head coach of a team somewhere. I haven't ruled out international cricket, and I'm just learning and getting all those little bits back together by doing little trips. Like I had a trip with England in the winter for sort of 2 weeks in South Africa, so... The more and more I do of it, the better I get, the more confident I get. I'm going to be able to be happy enough to put myself back in those sort of situations when touring life, when the kids are a bit older, then things will hopefully be a bit better.
Well, Trez, thanks. I hope I speak on behalf of everybody that's been listening and Leon to say thanks very much for giving us your time and your thoughts. It's been fascinating, as ever, to speak to somebody who I thoroughly enjoyed playing alongside. And like I've said many times, one of the best players, I think, who's played cricket for England. So, again, thank you very much, Marcus Trzaskowski.
Thank you.
Pleasure, guys. Thank you, guys.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.